Good afternoon. Today is Wednesday, February 10th, and welcome to the Senate Judiciary Committee. So with us today, we have Vice Chairman Senator Schauer, Senator Keel, Senator Hughes, and Senator Meyer. So with that, thank you all for attending today. Thank you, of course, to all the helpers today, you guys. We have consistent helpers, and we appreciate all of you. Today, we will be talking about something that may be the most divisive thing in the history of America, and that's the masks. So first of all, we are going to have Scott Stansberry. He is a process safety management consultant in Anchorage. And I want to let the committee members know we will be taking questions. And if you can hold the questions till the end, it's better. But I'm happy to take questions as we go, because I think sometimes it's easier when you're in the middle of a presentation and you got a question on that issue. Sometimes it's just easier to stop. So if you've got a burning question, you guys don't hesitate, okay? So we're going to make sure he's on. Kelly, we're all set to go. Okay, so I'm going to go ahead and do a quick introduction with Mr. Stansberry. He worked for one of the world's leading authorities in process safety management. His true passion is in the prevention and loss of life. We got a little bit of feedback and a mic. Okay. He's been public speaking for many years with the board of directors of major oil and chemical companies, led the risk assessments for NASA on International Space Station operations, and many other projects. With that, we are going to go ahead and have Mr. Stansberry, if you could please state your name, and also if you need us to do anything with the slides. I'm sure you and Kelly have coordinated that. And his slide presentation will be available on BASIS. I want to let everybody know. So please proceed, Scott.
My name is Scott Stansberry, and Ms. Chairman and committee members, I want to thank you for the opportunity to talk with you today. I am considered an industry expert in OSHA regulations regarding respiratory protection. I have 35 years expertise in process safety management, which is also known as PSM. As a sought-after consultant, I specialized in risk analysis, risk mitigation, OSHA regulations, OSHA compliance, and much more. PSM is an engineering field in which I had hundreds of clients in every continent. The areas that I consulted in were oil and gas, chemicals, power generation, NASA, and military. During my tenure, I have been involved with many of the world-famous industrial emergency responses. Those range from explosions to major accidents that have killed hundreds of people. I have been an incident commander, a lead incident investigator, and instructor all throughout the U.S. For 25 years, I was an active member of a volunteer fire and EMS department in the state of Texas, and I did this to serve my local community. I have logged over 5,000 EMS calls as a lead medic on an ambulance, and I've also flown with LifeLight, which is an air ambulance for Herman Hospital out of Houston, Texas. From industrial explosions and chemical releases to the many types of community emergency medical responses, I have firsthand knowledge and experience that few will ever bear witness to. I am a strong advocate of safety that is proven with data and science to protect the people and the environment. There are a multitude of OSHA regulations for all industries that they must follow. They can be difficult for many people to understand, and it should be noted that federal, state, and cities are exempt from all OSHA regulations. It is up to each entity to set up their own workplace standards and procedures. There are three major regulations, areas that I'm going to focus on. These are going to cover the workplace, outside of the workplace, and public health. Much emphasis from the media has been placed on the use of masks, and that is why I'm here today. It should be noted that all medical professionals and health facilities have little to no expertise in the area of respiratory protection. They are, however, experts in healing the body, for which I am truly grateful. OSHA and scientists of NIOSH are the experts in respiratory protection. That is why hospitals and health professionals must follow the OSHA-prescribed requirements for PPE. They don't have to understand the science behind the PPE. They just have to know how to use it when it's required. There are two types of respiratory protection. They fall under air purifying and atmosphere supplied. Most everything that we're hearing about today is the N95, which is an air purifying device. This is what our medical professionals are using. In Anchorage, the EMS personnel are using a full-face respirator that is connected to a self-contained atmosphere supplied unit that is strapped to their back. This is to supply non-contaminated air for them to breathe. These devices are very expensive, but they do offer 100% security from inhaling contaminated air. They have a positive air pressure in them, so if there's ever a leak in the face piece, the air will leak out and not allow any of the contaminated air in. These units are not the self-contained breathing apparatus that firefighters wear when they're on a fire or hazmat response. The N95 is considered a medical device. Therefore, they must go through extensive testing and be certified by NIOSH. NIOSH will test the filtration properties, the composition of the materials used, and the health effect for both acute and chronic illnesses. Respiratory protection is being used to protect the body from viruses, contaminated droplets, and aerosols, such as when you cough and sneeze. These both are about the size and how quickly they fall from the air. Know that aerosols can stay airborne for long periods of time, up to days, depending upon the air movement. The N95 is, next slide, please. The N95 is made for single use only and has four layers of compounds. These can see the makeup on them on the slide. As you can see, there's four different layers and four different compounds. Next slide, please. Air purifying respirators are designed to be effective to a certain micron level. A micron is a unit of measurement. Most people cannot comprehend such small units of measurements. As example, the size of COVID-19 virus is 0.125 microns. What that means is that it is 0.125 millionths of 1 meter. To put things into perspective, a human hair is about 70 microns, and a ping pong ball is 38,000 microns. In other words, to most people, a ping pong ball is simply 1.5 inches. Next slide. An N95 is designed to be 95% effective at 0.3 microns. The smaller the particle size, the less chance the N95 has to stop the contamination from entering the lungs. COVID is 2.4 times smaller than what the respirator can stop. Most of what the public is wearing is non-surgical mask and homemade mask. These are both made from loose weave material purchased at the local stores on the cloth mask. Using an example of a bed sheet with a 600 thread count, it would have more filtering properties than other fabrics because of their very loose weave. Still, this places the space between the threads or the air gap between the threads at 42.3 microns. This means that the virus is 388 times smaller than what a 600 thread count material can stop. Next slide, please. As a visual, the blue box is scaled up to 0.3 microns, which the N95 can stop. You can see that the virus is smaller than that of the N95. To get a better understanding on size, the picture has been scaled up 305,000%. Yes, we have to go that level to get a better visual and understanding with which to relate it to. In the picture, the virus is now the size of a ping pong ball. Remember, that was an inch and a half. Using that same scale, the air gap between the N95 fibers would now be 3.6 inches across. Going with that same skill and using the mask made with a 600 thread count, the 42 micron air gap between the fibers would now equate to 42 and a half feet apart. And we got to think about it. If a fence was a mask, we would still have mosquito problems in Alaska. There's a multitude of problems with the masks that people are wearing. First, they are not NIOSH approved. The materials and dyes have not been tested for both acute and chronic health effects. They do not seal around the face and allow for aerosols to both enter into the mask and escape from the mask. The air gap between the fibers are too large also to stop any contaminants from entering the lungs. OSHA has even put on their website, and this is an exact quote, cloth and non-surgical masks will not protect you against airborne transmissible infectious agents. That is an exact quote from OSHA's website that they now have put online. When it comes to why so many people are catching the virus, some of it is due to the human factors that are coming into play. As demonstrated by the chart, human factors are broken down into four categories. The more frequent we do a task, the more likely it is for us to make a mistake and be exposed to the hazard. So how does this come into play with a mask? When a person wears a mask, they are constantly touching their face to adjust the face covering. Then they remove it to eat and drink and never sanitize their hands before touching their face and again afterwards. With a large air gap between the cloth fibers, it allows droplets and aerosols to easily penetrate the material and be inhaled into the lungs. I have observed this thousands of times, and none of the proper procedures have been utilized. Just a few days ago, I went to pick up a friend at the day surgery center. When I walked up to the receptionist, there was a full plexiglass barrier from counter to ceiling and from wall to wall. This completely separated the waiting area from receptionist area. The receptionist wanted me to pick up a telephone in front of the plexiglass to talk to her. This same phone has had hundreds of the public with no sanitation between uses. Each person putting the mouthpiece to their face, I witnessed person after person doing the same. I, however, did not touch the phone and talk loudly so she could hear me. This is just one instance of thousands that I have witnessed and observed, including grocery stores that we all must go to. Often intentions are great, but the outcomes are horrible. Next slide, please. Human factors are probably the largest contributing factor causing the transmission of the disease from person to person. Very few people, if ever, wash reusable masks. They will shove them in their pocket, throw them on a car seat, put them on a desk. Wherever they might be, that's where it sits. They never sanitize their hands. And at the grocery store, they're touching everything, constantly touching their mask. I have watched many meetings online of people after people constantly adjusting their masks, touching their microphones from person to person, and again, no sanitation. But then there is the inherent hazards with the masks themselves from people not watching them or reusing them. Even in Dr. Fauci's peer-reviewed paper, he stated that the vast majority of fatalities in the 1918-1919 Spanish flu pandemic was from bacterial pneumonia caused by wearing the cloth mask. There was a controlled study in Denmark that had 6,000 people in that study. In that study, half the participants wore a mask all of the time and the other half did not. This study found that the contraction of virus was statistically the same. Another controlled study in Hanoi, Vietnam, involved 15 different hospitals. They had three different groups and found that the penetration of cloth masks versus the controlled group of the virus infection rates were actually higher with the cloth mask. To recap, cloth and non-surgical masks do not form a tight seal which allows for exposures of droplets and aerosols to enter into the lungs. They do not have the filtration requirements properties due to the large gaps between the fibers. They do not have the desired prophylactic effects, and people are constantly touching their face, thus increasing the potential for contracting the virus. It is in my expert opinion that masks are exacerbating the transmission of the disease, and for that, I recommend that these emergency orders be stopped. I have included a list of references, should you wish to pursue any of them. And with that, Ms. Chair and committee members, I thank you very much for your time, and I will be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Excellent. Thank you very, very much, Scott. We do appreciate that, and I want to let everybody online know that we will be uploading this, if it's not already uploaded, to BASIS, and we will be posting as well to Facebook. But with that, we're going to go ahead and take questions. Let's start with Senator Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not familiar with the Fauci study that our presenter referred to. I am familiar with the Fauci, Morin's, Taubenberger study, which was peer-reviewed, in which the researchers said that the 1918 influenza pandemic caused lung irritation, and the lack of modern medicine made it more likely that secondary infections would kill people. That did not, in fact, mention masks as a risk factor in any way. If we could get a reference, a citation to the one that said masks actually caused that, I haven't seen that one, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you. We will follow up. Okay. Mr. Senator Schauer.
Mr. Schauer. Sorry. I was just curious if maybe he knew if he had an answer to Senator Keel's question.
I don't know.
Okay.
Scott, if you have an answer, please feel free. If not, we can follow up with a reference.
Yes, I did include a reference to that study on the, that would have been slide number 17, and I have a direct reference to that.
Okay, thank you. Senator.
There were about 10 citations. Could I just,
which reference?
Which one?
Direct one? Sounds like he knows.
Yeah, okay. We need to move on, and we will circle back around. Senator Schauer.
So two questions for you. Thanks for the information. One recently, it seems recently, there's a lot of talk now that they're talking about double masking, and just based on your data, I was curious if you had thoughts or information on double, triple masking, and if it would make a difference based on that. I mean, I'm guessing not, but I would be curious to hear what you think of that based on the micron level and the size of the particles and airflow, et cetera. Second thing is, it's a little bit different, suppressed is maybe not the right word, but it hasn't really broken. And there was a study from Wuhan that was peer reviewed in the UK and Australia from China that talked about zero transmission, zero asymptomatic transmission. And so I was just curious if you had any comments on those two things. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Senator. These masks are cloth. Will never give you the filtration properties to be able to stop the penetration. And then plus, they do not form a tight seal around your face. And even in the OSHA regs, it states that if with any respiratory device, you cannot have any facial hair. So we have all these men that have long mustaches and beards. The mask will never form a tight seal. And so that's why the hospitals and everybody are using the N95, because they do form a tight seal around the face. Now, when it comes to the cloth, even the surgical masks, they are not made to have a tight seal. So you'll always have an air gap for the aerosols to be inhaled into the lungs. Now, it has problems because, again, remember the graphic of the fence with the mosquitoes. The size of the holes or the air gaps are just way too big, and it's not feasible. Even if you double, triple, or quadruple, you would still have the exact same situation. Now, on the study out of Wuhan, I am not familiar with that one, and so therefore I'm not going to have any speculation on that, sir.
Thank you. And Scott, I have some questions. First of all, I don't know if you're aware. I don't think I talked to you about this, but here in the legislature, if we don't have a mask on, even though basically everybody, most if not everybody, tests for COVID, and they can't come in the building unless it's negative, we are still being forced to wear these things on our faces. And if we don't, which I genuinely believe they can tell you to wear a paper bag on your head tomorrow if they can tell you to wear a mask today, or a MAGA hat tomorrow if they can force you to wear a mask today, I just really think it crosses civil inherent liberties. But the bottom line is you can get fined $250 for the first time and $500 for the second time. I don't even know if Ledge Council has the legal authority to do that, but the bottom line is we're still being told to wear these things all day, even though, you know, you're required to be negative to be in the building. So, one, I'm not sure if you're aware of that. I wanted to just let you know that. And I also wanted to talk to you in regards to a couple concerns I have. For example, I go into my Federal Credit Union bank. They will not serve me unless I put a mask on. But there's federal law saying you can't wear a mask over your face in a bank. So they literally send me across a community about 20, 25 minutes away in regards to that. And you probably aren't an expert in regards to, you know, the federal laws with masks and things like that. But it really does cause me pause. I don't know if you want to make a comment on the workplace requiring people to wear masks. I've told in Fred Meyer when I go in there that these guys will get fired if they don't have it on. I could just go on and on and on about different issues with the mask. I don't know. Do you want to weigh in on that, or is that something you're not comfortable with?
I can weigh in on part of it, yes, ma'am. And thank you for that question, Madam Chair. When it comes to the workplace, the way OSHA talks about it is they look at if it's going to be an IDLH atmosphere. In other words, is it immediately dangerous to life and health? And you have to have somebody that's highly trained and qualified to go into these facilities to, one, test the air quality, know what kind of respiratory protection is required, and there's a lot of factors that go into it, such as fit testing and medical evaluations and all this other bit. But here your OSHA has said that anytime someone wears a respirator, which is used to protect your health, you have to go through all these evaluations. And anytime you an employee is being mandated to do this and they don't follow the regulations, which they're not, it creates a problem that, one, it puts the employer in violation of the federal codes of regulations. The employees are in violation of the codes of federal regulations. In addition to all of that, they can both be held liable for civil fines, criminal potential that could lead up to jail time, as well as immediate shutdown of a business. Now, as far as banks go, I understand that there's a federal law that says you can't wear a mask into a bank. I can't comment on that. That is not my area of expertise. But safety in the workplace, that is my specialty.
And so I don't see any other questions right at the moment. I'm just going to follow through real quick with that. I believe that masks, I've been hearing lots of people show me sighs in their eyes. I know I can tell you I cut my eye adjusting a mask. Lots of people I go around and I ask, and I would say 90% of the people hate wearing them when I go around, and I almost everywhere I go I ask people. I know people are getting sinus infections, acne, asthma, anxiety, pleurisy. and a fear of losing their job, let alone fines, which they're all being told the fairy tale that these masks protect them from COVID, even though on the box it says that it doesn't. And I don't know if you want to weigh in regards to that. Maybe that's a better question for the lawyer who is next, the constitutional lawyer. Is that something you want to weigh in on, Scott?
Oh, yes, ma'am, please. So there are so many complications that set up from not washing the mask. You got bacteria that starts growing in it. It can lead to so many different issues. And then you got people that have chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, also known as COPD. Now they have trouble breathing to begin with, and now you're putting something in front of their face when they're already having trouble getting air into their lungs. Now, with all this vaccine stuff, and I know there's a lot of pros and cons, and people are battling both sides. I'm not going to get into that. I, myself, am in a high-risk category for catching COVID because of my medical issues or history that I have. Now, with me, I'm not going to wear a mask because I know that it has zero chances of protecting me. Now, I am trained in the use of wearing respirators, and I know not to touch my face. But still, even if I was absolutely forced to wear a mask, I'm not going to touch my face. But I know they're absolutely useless. I just showed you the facts, the data, and the science that goes behind them. And truth is not fiction. You know, this is real science. It's real data. And this is put out by NIOSH and OSHA.
Okay, and Scott, you know what? I just realized we're running behind. I was so interested in your conversation. I lost track of time. But if you could take one more quick question. I told Nathan McPherson he'd be right on at 2 o'clock. So, Jesse, Senator Keel, would you make it quick?
I had a bunch of questions once we were getting into the data presented. Challenging to do just one. I very much appreciate Mr. Stansbury's expertise. I'm a little confused at all the discussions about the size of a single virion because, of course, individual viruses aren't what are expelled by infected persons. It's droplets and microdroplets, which have a tendency to run generally from 1 micron up to 10 or more. And I guess I had some significant questions about the notion that the size of a gap in a single ply was the determinative factor when the recommendations are all for multi-ply masks. It's a little, Madam Chair, one willow bush in front of me, I can probably get a good shot at the vitals of a moose. 3 willow bushes in front of me, and I didn't get my moose again. But maybe the question for Mr. Stansbury, he's spoken about various types of masks in terms of their use to protect the wearer from transmission. Maybe a better question for Mr. Stansbury would be the role of masking in source control, and especially when it comes to infectious agents. What I generally have read is that masks are relatively effective in protecting transmission by expulsion of the droplets and microdroplets that infected people give off when they speak, shout, or sing. And so maybe a discussion of the difference between personal protection and source control in the data that he talked about here.
Okay, Scott, if you could weigh in quickly. That was a long question, but if you could weigh in quickly, that'd be great.
Sure. So The issue is they don't seal around the face, and so you're breathing in the aerosols from the other person can still come in to your breath or when you inhale because they are not sealed around the face. If you get water spraying straight at you, yes, but remember, aerosols can stay airborne for days at a time. And so you could what if this thing all day long, but the fact is you're still going to breathe the aerosol from the other user. And that's where the issue comes into play.
Okay, and with that,
that's the question I didn't ask.
With that, if we can bring him back. I mean, you know, this is a conversation I'd love to have over and over and over again. You know, I think this is a huge, huge issue. Even the right to travel. People, I know with kids that are disabled, they cannot wear a mask. The children, and they cannot. Their families are stranded in Alaska. And I just find it. That's why I want to have Alaska Airlines before the committee. I just found a board member I know, and I'm gonna talk to them. I'm gonna do the best I can to get them before, because I believe that this is a civil rights issue. It's a when travel was part of the First Amendment, because we didn't have internet and all that way back then, and the right to travel came with the First Amendment. And I just believe the First Amendment is completely being violated right now if people are not being allowed. You know, to travel. And you know, I know that this is a longer discussion. I didn't really want to go here right now, but the right to travel is an inherent right, and people are not being allowed to travel and they're being forced, actually self-incriminated. You cannot get on that plane unless you agree to do something that you may completely disagree with. But you know what, Scott, I definitely like to ask, do you know anything about air compression in a cabin in an airplane, and whether it's less oxygenated, and maybe the mask even creates even more difficult time to breathe? Because I can tell you, I have a tough time when I'm walking and have any type of thing on my face. I have a hard time breathing deeply. So do you have any comments in regards to compressorized cabinets in an airplane?
Yes, ma'am. They pressurize the cabins, from my understanding, to 12,000 or 10,000 feet atmosphere, and so there is a lot less oxygen at 10,000 foot versus sea level. So that would explain why a lot of people have breathing difficulties when they're in an airplane.
Okay, and Senator Schauer wants to add to it.
And I have a little expertise on this one for a chance, because most of this medical stuff I have no idea, not being a doctor. So I will add, I want to, not from the COVID perspective, but with the mask and all of this. So an average aircraft, when the airliner, depending on the altitude it travels at, like I said, it's kind of my business, you'll see a cabin altitude anywhere from about 6 to up to 8,000-ish feet. And I would give you the, if you want to equate that, say you go to Denver, where it's 6,000-ish feet or so, and you're walking around and you're up and down stairs and you're kind of getting, you know, it's hard to breathe if you're not, you know, familiar with that. So 8,000 feet is kind of the range you'll generally see a cabin altitude that's held to pressure-wise while you're in the airliner at the normal 35-ish plus or minus 1,000 cruising foot altitude, Senator Reinbold. So I just thought that was important, because if people are wearing a mask and struggling, there is no doubt that it would certainly be equivalent to running around Colorado at 6,000 or 7,000 feet with a mask on. It's going to be a little harder, especially if you're not adjusted to that atmosphere already. So it's just from the pure physiological perspective, I just want to throw that out there. Those are the numbers.
Okay, and thank you, and I do feel like people should be allowed to wear a mask if it makes them feel safe, if for placebo effect or whatever. I think it's a different situation, a clinical setting. I am not 100% anti-mask. I just think every day people being required to wear masks, we don't know the long-term safety and health effects, but if they're being told that they have to based on COVID, I just personally do not support being told something that is not true. And you know, some people, it all depends on which type of a mask that you wear. But the reason I wanted to have this OSHA here is people are telling me they're being threatened to lose their jobs on a regular basis if they do not wear this. And it's all based on the premise that, one, they either have COVID and they could spread it, or that this mask protects them. And I just think that facts need to be proven. Science is observable, repeatable, and measurable. And just spreading something because government is telling you to do it is just really a challenge for me. With that, we've got to move on to Nathan McPherson. Nathan, I'm sorry that we're a few minutes late in regards to your presentation. First of all, I want to say that Nathan McPherson is a friend of mine. I have known Nathan for a good 10 years. We did symposiums across the state exposing the dangers of Common Core, so I want to definitely get that on the record that I worked closely with you. I consider you a friend, and He is a constitutional attorney from Northern Idaho. Nathan McPherson is a second-generation constitutional attorney. His father, Mac McPherson, is a West Point graduate, class of 67, airborne infantry officer in Green Beret. Wow. Launched the firm's tax practice, trying and winning 8 criminal tax cases back and forth, both federal and state court, in Alaska in 1979, the year Nathan was born. Nathan has since taken over the family law firm, which he grew up and is admitted to practice law on 2 continents, and his clients have ranged from foreign finance ministries and major global banks to publicly traded company and bank director to public officials to German nobility, Hollywood star, a 5-star restaurant, pastors, churches, individuals, civil and criminal tax issues. His practice is nationwide. Recently, Nathan did constitutional work, which included representing Lieutenant Governor of Idaho and 64 state legislators from 9 states, including me, and 6 legislators from Alaska. In an amicus brief filed with the United States Supreme Court in the 2020 election case of Texas versus Pennsylvania, suing the governor of health, suing the governor and health director of Idaho on behalf of pastors and parishioners to keep Idaho churches open. Churches in Idaho have been fully open since the lawsuit. Congratulations. And suing Idaho State Health District on behalf of local business owners to end the mask mandates. The district repealed the mandate that was subject to the lawsuit, and you will be speaking about constitutional issues regarding the emergency orders. And with that, thank you for joining us, Nathan McPherson.
Thank you, Senator Weinberg. Thank you, Senators. Let me turn down my volume here just to make sure there's no echo. I'll start with a quote. If it suffices to accuse, what will become of the innocent?
Okay.
Otherwise said, okay, just if mere accusation is sufficient for conviction.
Nathan, can you just state your name? The record keeper's asking you to state your name.
Okay. Yeah, Nathaniel Kyle McPherson, also known as Nathan McPherson.
Please proceed.
Thank you. If mere accusation is sufficient for conviction, what will become of the innocent? This was Emperor Julian's retort to the plea of Delphidius, the accuser of Governor Numerius, who stood trial before the emperor. O illustrious Caesar, if it is sufficient to deny, what hereafter will become of the guilty? Delphidius was concerned that a guilty man, in this case his enemy, might go free. Emperor Julian was more concerned that an innocent man might be convicted. All of you have been accused of being infected with a highly contagious disease, a virus, even a deadly one. This, by the way, constitutes defamation per se under Alaska law and the law of, I believe, all 50 states, the accusation of having a loathsome disease. All of you were forced to prove your innocence, although no defendant in court is required to do so. And all of you did prove that you're not infected, or you wouldn't be sitting here in front of me. Yet you are still being required to cover your faces and to do so with material that, according to the last testimony, doesn't even stop the virus. Think about these facts for a moment. Consider the state of our legal system and our republic. Emperor Julian's retort in the 4th century echoed the legal maxim that has been the law across various empires for the past 3,500 years. Until now, the presumption of innocence. For some reason, certain people now want to abandon this legal doctrine that has stood firm across diverse empires for nearly 4 millennia. Premise number 1, due process is the foundation of the common law, our legal system. The presumption of innocence, also known as innocent until proven guilty or innocent until proven guilty in a court of law. This United States Supreme Court case of Coffin versus United States from 1895 stands for the proposition that this presumption of innocence is a fundamental right in American law. I quote, "The principle that there is a presumption of innocence in favor of the accused is the undoubted law, axiomatic and elementary, and its enforcement lies at the foundation of the administration of our criminal law." The court goes on to note that Greenleaf, a treatise on evidence, traces this presumption to Deuteronomy, the book of the Bible, written about 1500 BC, and quotes Mescidus de Probationibus to show that it was substantially embodied in the laws of both Sparta and Athens. Sparta was around 650 BC, Athens around 400 BC. Cicero, a Roman statesman, lawyer, and scholar in roughly the first century BC, is quoted as saying, "I would rather 10 guilty persons should escape than one innocent should suffer." Roman Emperor Trajan in the second century AD said, "A person ought not to be condemned on suspicion, for it is preferable that the crime of a guilty man should go unpunished than an innocent man be condemned." Even Alfred the Great in the ninth century echoed this ancient maxim, "In cases of doubt, one should rather save than condemn." Echoing Cicero, Sir John Fortescue, Chief Justice of the King's Bench, in 1471 stated, "Indeed, I would rather wish 10 evildoers to escape death through pity than one man to be unjustly condemned." And according to our United States Supreme Court, Blackstone, around the year 1750 or so, 1760, maintains that the law holds that it is better that 10 guilty persons escape than that one suffer. This enshrines the ancient doctrine of the presumption of innocence, or innocence until proven guilty in a court of law, into our American common law system, and thus it's also called Blackstone's ratio. Well, due process requires that we are all well unless we are proven to be unwell. Or otherwise said, the law must consider us not contagious until we have been proven to be contagious, not a threat to our fellow man until we're proven to be a threat to our fellow man. Indeed, Alaska Statute 18.15.385, subparagraph D, this is the quarantine and isolation statute, requires that, quote, "Before quarantining or isolating an individual, the department shall obtain a written order from the superior court authorizing the isolation or quarantine." Even subparagraph E, that allows some administrative action in exigent circumstances, goes on, "Notwithstanding D of this section, when the department has probable cause to believe that the delay involved in seeking a court order imposing isolation or quarantine would pose a clear and immediate threat to the public health," and goes on to allow for an administrative quarantine, but it requires a petition in the superior court and an emergency hearing within 48 hours for due process for a court of law to determine that this person is in fact a threat to fellow man. Further, under the due process clause, people have the liberty to refuse medical treatment. I quote here from Cruzan, a 1990 Supreme Court case, "A competent person has a liberty interest under the due process clause in refusing unwanted medical treatment." The Cruzan court noted, "Every human being of adult years and sound mind has a right to determine what shall be done with his own body, and a surgeon who performs an operation without his patient's consent commits an assault for which he is liable in damages." And further, the informed consent doctrine has become firmly entrenched in American tort law. Tort law being where you can sue somebody civilly for monetary damages. Also in 1990, the U.S. Supreme Court held that, quote, "The forcible injection of medication into a non-consenting person's body represents a substantial interference with that person's liberty." That's the case of Washington versus Harper. This line of Supreme Court decisions demonstrates constitutional protection against unwanted vaccination and intrusive examinations, possibly also masks. For instance, informed consent would also implicate the right to choose one's own medical provider. There are also privacy issues related to the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act of 1996, that's otherwise known as HIPAA. So why are we forced to divulge private medical information to strangers? Senator Reinbold noted that when you enter the Capitol, you have to answer questions. What kind of symptoms, what kind of medications, et cetera. In a public setting, in the hearing of others, possibly even in the hearing of news media, certainly in the hearing of others, right? it's a public place, that person who's questioning you is not your own doctor, then they're prescribing a medical device. Oh, wear this to stop a virus. That sounds to me like a medical device. What of our privacy rights under the Constitution? Fourth Amendment freedoms are implicated. I quote the United States Supreme Court in their 1891 case of Union Pacific Railroad Company versus Boxford. No right is held more sacred or is more carefully guarded by the common law than the right of every individual to the possession and control of his own person, free from all restraint or interference of others, unless by clear and unquestionable authority of law. Clear and unquestionable authority of law. Just a few years ago, in 2016, the United States Supreme Court held in Birchfield versus North Dakota that warrantless drunk driving blood tests are a Fourth Amendment violation. That's where they draw your blood to see if you're over the alcohol limit. Violation of the Fourth Amendment and any statute that would criminalize a refusal to submit to such blood tests is a violation of the Fourth Amendment. The court noted, in quoting Skinner, a case from 1942 that struck down court imposition of sterilization of those convicted of crimes. Yes, we used to do that in this country, vasectomies and so forth, if you were convicted of certain crimes. That was struck down by the Supreme Court in Skinner with this quote: requiring piercing the skin and compelled physical intrusion beneath the defendant's skin and into his veins are, quote, significant bodily intrusions. That sounds to me like it goes to the heart of forced vaccination. Query whether that also applies to forcing somebody to strap something to his face against his will and restrict his breathing against his will. Broadly speaking, the Fourth Amendment protects people against unreasonable searches and seizures. And due to the fact that there seems to be a pandemic in this country of constitutional illiteracy, I'll read the Fourth Amendment here. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue, but upon probable cause supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. Query what probable cause there is, and who would be willing to swear an oath that any of you is right now contagious, considering the fact that you just underwent medical examination, temperature scan, questionnaire, and COVID test. And note also that on its face, the Alaska quarantine statute requires probable cause. That was in the wording of the actual statute. And that this term has been clarified by the United States Supreme Court, so everybody knows what it means. Bottom line, reasonable prudence in the belief of a criminal activity for probable cause, which is to be distinguished from reasonable suspicion. There's a much higher standard for probable cause. Reasonable suspicion was articulated in the case of Terry, United States Supreme Court. That's where we get the term a Terry stop, which is where the police simply stop and frisk you and let you go. And that's why we have these YouTube videos of people asking, am I being detained? Am I being detained? Am I being detained? Because that distinguishes between a Terry stop, which requires reasonable suspicion, a lower burden, and detaining requires probable cause. Both of these, however, are objective standards, not subjective standards. Not, that guy scares me, I'm afraid, well, I just don't know, maybe he does have it and we don't know. No, an objective standard. The various orders that have been put in place, some of them are still in place, some of them in Alaska, other states as well, federal mandates now under the new administration, all of them seem to lack a rational basis and do not seem to be narrowly tailored, particularly in light of the last testimony we heard. Because fundamental rights are implicated, strict scrutiny is used. In other words, the highest level of scrutiny to see whether government has the authority to impose these burdens on the people. Because remember, in the American system of law, the government has certain powers enumerated and the people are free unless restricted by a statute particularly on point. The various orders cast large nets over the entire populace, whereas the CDC's own data documents that only a small percentage of the population actually has the virus. the various restrictions imposed are not narrowly tailored to the stated ends, requiring masks that, according to the manufacturers, according to the last testimony and so forth, don't stop it. I know there's conflicting data. Does it stop it? Doesn't it stop it? The point is, we can't agree on that, can we? Allowing some businesses to be open while others may not be, arbitrary determinations of whether anybody's essential or not essential. And consider the fact that when the government says you're not essential, are we surprised that suicides are on the rise? Hey, you're not essential. Might as well just kill yourself. Think about it. Oh, but we're here to save lives.
Excuse me. Madam Chair.
Just a second. Nathan, we've got to do a point of order.
Madam Chair, I'm going to ask you to please maintain enough decorum that we don't accuse anyone of actively encouraging suicide when that did not happen.
Point.
Am I being accused of saying that?
Point taken. Okay, Mr. McPherson, can you please proceed?
Yes. Several courts across the country have thus held in various religious freedom cases. There are many of them that won. The Supreme Court recently overturned prior cases that kept churches closed. Various shutdown statutes in various states were overturned by state courts. And I think we do need to address this point of whether we're here to save lives or not. Suicides are up. That's a fact. That's confirmed by CDC. I personally know a pastor's son, a friend of mine, a friend of my children, 16 years old, committed suicide during the first wave of lockdowns. Life didn't seem worth living in this changed world. And he's not alone. That's been reported widely. Elderly are dying alone of loneliness, not of COVID, but of old age and loneliness. My own sister-in-law wasn't able to see her mother for her last days, wasn't even permitted to identify her dead mother's own body before burial. Another good friend of mine wasn't able to see his mother for the last roughly 8 months of her life until she died in a retirement home. If we really want to save lives, according to the CDC, abortion is the largest cause of loss of life every year in this country. Yet, where has Representative Eastman's House Bill 178, the Alaska Life at Conception Act, gone? Not out of committee. Why? Oh, because it would be unconstitutional under Roe v. Wade to curtail a woman's right to kill her child. But we don't seem to care about the Constitution when it comes to masking people and these other things that are dubious at best whether they save lives. The number of people dying is much, much, much lower. It's not the leading cause of death, even besides abortion, which is heart disease. First Amendment rights are implicated, and I'll note here that First Amendment rights are always under strict scrutiny. Freedom of speech is restricted by hiding one's face. We all know, we learned in school, that body language is more than half of verbal communication, right? The fact that you can see my face, see my gestures, and so forth, conveys much more than simply my words and even my tone. And my tone would be, if I were like this, you'd have trouble even hearing my intonation, right? I would not be able to communicate with you as effectively. That's why we're on a video conference rather than simply a phone call for me, right? Hiding a face, in addition to the social distancing, puts a further barrier to communication, right? Freedom of association is restricted. I mean, it goes without saying that if you're not allowed to go meet with other people, you're not able to associate with them, right? And we know that virtual relationships aren't the same. If that were the case, you know, why do you want to be in the same house as your husband or wife, your children, and so forth, right? Freedom of religion, this is very important. This goes to the core of our fundamental rights in this country in particular. Freedom of religion is violated because it's against the sincerely held beliefs of many Christians that hide one's face, to stay away from other people, to stay away from church on Sunday, failing to gather together, and being vaccinated. I sent Senator Reinbold some links to research regarding vaccines, fetal tissue use, religious implications to that. And let's state that the following. Sacramental churches believe that the actual body and blood of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ is present with the bread and wine in communion, and that you are to partake of that every Sunday. That would be Roman Catholics, Eastern Orthodox, Confessional Lutherans, Anglicans, I believe, as well. That can't be done online. You can't eat bread and wine online. Sacramentarian Christians believe that the gathering together of believers is not to be forsaken, irrespective of whether there's a virus or not. During times of Roman persecution, the churches would hide and meet secretly. They would risk their lives. They would be executed for gathering together and participating in the Eucharist. Now in our country, in the United States of America, for the past year, across the country, Christians have been meeting in secret, in hiding, at threat of prosecution, and two pastors have been arrested because they dared to have church on Sunday in the United States of America. Think about that. It was under pagan Rome the last time I remember this happening in history class, about 2,000 years ago. And in fact, in Moscow, Idaho, not Moscow, Russia, though it might sound like it, Moscow, Idaho, the police told a pastor there that it would be against the law for him to even take some bread and wine to his parishioner's house, drop it at the doorstep, step back and be 6, 10, 20 feet away and say the Lord Jesus on the night he was betrayed and so forth, administer the sacrament of Holy Communion. But if he were an Uber Eats driver and dropped off the bags of groceries and said, hey, here's your bread and wine, have a nice day, enjoy your meal, that would be legal. That's why we sued the governor of Idaho and the health director in Idaho. That's outrageous that that happens in this country. I also have some resources of some pastors, including a U.S. Marine Corps chaplain. He's a lieutenant commander of the U.S. Navy. He's a chaplain. He's a missionary. He's a pastor with the Lutheran Church of Missouri Synod. Wrote an article and has given radio shows about faith coverings violating his religious beliefs. My brother, who's history department chair at Bethany Lutheran College, has a PhD from Notre Dame, has written various articles. I've sent those to Senator Reinbold, documenting vaccinations and whether or not they contain fetal cells. We're researching using fetal cells and so forth. He's presented to Lutherans for Life and other pro-life organizations. I'll end with this. By imposing a mode of worship and conduct, the various orders are imposing a new belief system according to the ancient theological maxim, lex orandi, lex credendi. This was first articulated by the Prosper of Aquitaine in the 5th century. He was a disciple of St. Augustine of Hippo, famous in history. Again, lex orandi, lex credendi. That stands for the proposition that how we pray, and that includes using body motions. Why does the church do certain physical motions? That dictates how we believe, which in reality dictates in whom we believe, what God we actually worship. These various restrictions, in particular the covering of the face, are imposing new words of worship, new ways of worship of different gods under this ancient theological maxim. And there are numerous pastors and priests, Eastern Orthodox, Roman Catholic, Lutheran, Baptist, you name it, from all versions of Christianity who will affirm this, that that's their sincerely held belief in many parishioners. So I'll summarize. The presumption of innocence is the foundation of our common law system. And all of these measures are premised on a presumption of guilt, a presumption that a person is contagious until proven not contagious. But worse, even when you're proven not contagious, you're still required to distance, wear a mask, etc., to act as if you are contagious, even though you were just proven not contagious. This betrays the fact that the measures in these various restrictions lack a reasonable basis and are not narrowly tailored to serve the legitimate police power of the state. Even those who have tested well are required to act as if they're contagious, but they have to do so by means that don't actually stop the spread of the virus, according to the last testimony, for instance. The Supreme Court cases across the centuries demonstrate that fundamental constitutional rights are implicated, and therefore strict scrutiny is to be used. Indeed, the entire substance of our republic is threatened by the abandonment of these fundamental common law principles and the adoption of new, strange practices. Never before in the history of our country has science been the rationale behind policy? Think about that for a second. We use science to determine what measure of damage will happen if a car going this speed hits a car going that speed. But that doesn't determine whether the speed limit should be 25 miles an hour or 50 miles an hour exactly. We don't say even one life saved, we should lower the speed limit, because then the speed limit would be zero, wouldn't it? So it's not science that's dictating public policy until with this virus. Never before have we abandoned the principle of innocent until proven guilty, where we presume everybody contagious and then prove them not to be contagious and then still treat them as if they're contagious. We're being conditioned to believe differently, to abandon our Republican common law principles, Republican form of government, that is, not Republican versus Democrat, and believe that the role of government is to keep us safe, not merely even to keep us safe, but to keep us healthy, like the government's now our doctor. And actually, they're forcing us to use government agents as doctors, such as the contractors working at the Capitol of Alaska, rather than the point of government being to secure our God-given fundamental rights, as it's stated in the Declaration of Independence, to secure these rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Governments are instituted among men. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Person. Is there any questions? Okay, we have the same lineup as last time. We're going to go ahead and start with Senator Keel, if you want one or two questions, and we'll move to Senator Schauer, because we still have some public testimony online. I have to get to public testimony. We've got like 10 people on the line right now, and so we need to just ask maybe even one question each. I have one, so we can get the. Okay, we got four questions. We're each going to get one question, and then I may need to bring you back. Okay, so let's start with Senator Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And as you requested, I held questions to the end. I certainly have more than one. It was a fascinating presentation. I think it took sort of civil and criminal law and put them in quite a blender. And so it's difficult to sort of tease out the principles that actually underlay the arguments there, because they shifted so fast. So I guess rather than take exception to the notion that our drinking water standards or our vehicle design rules aren't based on science, and that this is the first time science has ever dictated public policy, maybe what I'll ask is sort of a question that goes to the principle. It seems that The notion underlying the presentation is that government may not act to protect citizens either from themselves or from external harms in an emergency situation. And I guess given that we do that in so many places in non-emergent situations, I mean, I think, Madam Chair, about a fence around a military institution. I think about driver licensing that requires a knowledge test and a road test. We could go on. I wonder if Mr. McPherson could give us his view on when and how government can apply general standards for safety in a civil context.
I believe you've misconstrued what I clearly stated. And that is that where fundamental constitutional rights are affected, strict scrutiny is to be used. And in many, if not all, of these various measures undertaken in the past year or so, strict scrutiny was not used. In other words, they were not narrowly tailored and so forth. They were rather haphazard, and several courts have thus held. For instance, the court in Pennsylvania that struck down the Pennsylvania statutes Pennsylvania lockdown laws and church closures held exactly thus. So I'm simply echoing what that court said as one instance, or what the court said that opened up churches in various locations around the country.
Okay, and Senator Schauer.
Thank you. I will say that Communist China is restricting Christians, just so you know. I know what you said about that, but I can validate that going there often. Just as quickly, because I know time's an issue, can you just some very brief thoughts on hearing different things about private companies being able to restrict access, et cetera? There's also a legal argument against, like, say, you know, airlines where people have to travel but they're being restricted, grocery stores where people need to go, and just without, because this I'm sure could be a long topic, just some generic thoughts on this more constitutional level on can businesses right. restrict people, especially okay. ones where they need access? I don't know.
Right, so grocery store, hotel, airline, maybe a taxi cab. I would say replace someone who's not wearing a mask with someone whose skin color is black or someone who identifies as a lesbian and see what the law would say. And that basically public accommodation laws apply certain constitutional principles to businesses that hold them out to be the public. They even take the case of the baker who refused to bake a wedding cake. You know, that was all over the news. And I know there are some nuances in that case. But broadly speaking, just because you're a public business doesn't mean you can do whatever you want as a broad principle.
Okay. Senator Hughes.
Yeah, thank you very much for joining us today, Nathan. You gave us quite a bit of history. So I was just thinking back to the history of 1918, the Spanish flu. Was strict scrutiny applied then, or can you give us a little history of whether they crossed the line then, and if so, how, or if they did not?
I'm not familiar with whether there were any cases arising directly out of the Spanish flu or whether it actually went to court. I know there was some masking, there were anti-maskers, but I'm not familiar with whether that was actually tested in the courts. I don't believe I've seen any cases on that. Which is interesting.
If you would have the time to follow up, I'd be curious, since that's here in our country, I'd like to know. Thank you.
Thank you. And then yes. I'm going to close by asking a question because I got to get to. I got to get to the public testimony, but I want to just mention the Alaska Airlines issue. I know you're a little bit familiar with it. But the problem is with Alaska Airlines is, first of all, I want to get on the record that there was no harsh words with anybody in Alaska Airlines and me. I know the media had a heyday with a private post on a personal page. I get it. And I know people, they put me as a character in a story that they wanted to write that was completely misconstrued. But the bottom line, I just want to get on record that I was asked by Alaska Airlines to wear two masks. So I was asked to wear two masks because they said that mine didn't cover my chin. I was wearing a mask. And this is what bothers me, is the misconstruing of what happened in the media. And I didn't want to wear a mask. I'll be straight up. I could go on and on and on about my personal opinions in regards to them, but I definitely believe that these are something that should not be mandated or forced on people. But I wanted to go back to the cabin pressure. And I want to say thank you, Senator Schauer, for, I know you're a commercial pilot, but in regards to Alaska Airlines being asked to wear two masks in a pressurized compartment, even if someone did or did not have a health care exemption, do you want to just weigh in quickly on that? And if you have any thoughts, because I was told that public accommodations need to accommodate the public. And the clothing, you know, being required to wear clothing is a completely different issue than wearing a covering on your face. And I know that this governor forced us to wear coverings on our faces, you know, in basically state buildings, and even in his health alerts. When they were doing a service for Easter, right before Easter, it was in health alerts to cover your faces, to talk to a clergyman, and how far your car is to be parked away during an Easter service. I mean, I was blown away by what happened this last Easter, but I don't want to complicate that issue. I want to thank you for your work on religious freedom. Thank you. It's a sacred, sacred right in this country. But if you could weigh in on that, I would really appreciate it.
Sure, and I just thought of something in regards to Senator Hughes' question. Is that the law has developed quite a bit in the past 100 years or so since then, such that we now have much more case law addressing this issue. Even, for instance, starting with Roe versus Wade, bodily autonomy, the case, I forget the name of it, but prior to that, it discussed the penumbras of the Constitution that sort of broaden, the distinct wording of a Constitution, the amendments like the Fourth Amendment, might be a few words, but the penumbras is a legal term the Supreme Court used. Broaden that to include sort of all the aspects, and then several cases since then, such as several of those I cited, have further developed this area of case law. So it's much richer than it was 100 years ago. But I'm happy also to look into the question like you requested. As to Alaska Airlines or any airline, I know a lot of people have notes from their own primary care physicians, licensed doctors who have a patient relationship with the person who have advised regarding the use of any kind of face covering, et cetera, and the airlines have blanket refused to accept those. And I know Delta Airlines, for instance, has subjected passengers to questioning by a, quote, Delta doctor. And I mean, I'm a Diamond Medallion member with Delta, so that affected me quite a bit. I've stopped flying now because of this, because, you know, I have my own doctors. They know me. They have my medical history. They've seen me. They know exactly who I am and what medical conditions I have. I didn't contract with Delta Airlines or any other airline to engage in a medical relationship. I want them to fly me from A to B safely. And to be on the phone in a terminal with other passengers surrounding you and to be asked medical questions is, appears to me to be a HIPAA violation. I'm not a HIPAA lawyer, but that seems to me to be quite an issue. It seems that they could be extending quite a bit of liability to themselves, which is perhaps why some of these laws are being pushed through to limit liability to various people for various things regarding the virus. That it's, when have we seen this before in our history as a nation, that now not even government, but private companies can dictate medical policy to you? Now, regarding facial coverings or any kind of clothing, we do have some case history. There's an EEOC case, I don't remember the citation, but it was in the past 20 years or so, let's say, you know, a recent case brought by the EEOC, the Equal Opportunity Federal Government Branch, because a Muslim woman was interviewing for a job and refused to not wear her head covering, you know, that Muslims wear, and they didn't even take her further from that first interview. It wasn't even being fired or anything. They just said, we're not even, I think it was they even refused to interview her. And the government sued, saying that's religious discrimination. She has a religious purpose for wearing that clothing, and you, a prospective employer, not even the actual employer, but prospective, have no right to violate her religious rights there. And so that's another, by the way, example of private companies versus the government and these constitutional rights being applied to private companies. That's not even a public accommodation, actually. Another recent case, not case in the sense of a lawsuit, but it was settled at the administrative level, is a soldier, I believe he was even a West Point graduate, who was permitted in the Army to not shave his facial hair and to wear a particular head covering because I believe he's Sikh, or I forget the exact religion, but his religion regarded him as a man to have facial hair and to wear this certain hat. And even though the Army requires particular headgear and haircuts and so forth, and because of it was his religious belief, the Army accommodated that. So why not in the case of, there's certainly safety implications. I mean, the reason that the Army has rules regarding facial hair and head hair, haircut lengths and so forth, is for the safety of the soldiers, and include, you know, all of the soldiers collectively. So you could draw the same types of principles to stopping a virus.
Okay, so with that, I think what I took from that is they're basically practicing medicine without a license. They're overruling what a doctor says as a public accommodation. Did I hear that correctly?
Well, in the case of when I contacted Delta, I had my doctor's note, and they said, well, our doctor says this, and he wanted to talk to me. And so it's my doctor versus their doctor, except that I hired my doctor, and he has my entire medical file, so that's rather interesting. Then there's also the question of, you know, where are you licensed to practice medicine? Does that cover here or there?
Yeah, and I think that I'm Mr.
Legal math.
McPherson, I think I'm referring to the letter that we used before Palmer, in regards to practicing a license without medicine. And that was what I was talking, you know, in reference to. And with your permission, I'd like to submit that letter to the committee.
Sure.
Okay. And just so they're very, very, very clear, because I know I asked Alaska Airlines, and they said it didn't matter, that they're taking no exemptions. And even though they are a public accommodation, they said no, even if you have a doctor's, and I did this on behalf of several people, that are not able to fly. But with that, we're gonna probably have you back. Okay, there's a lot of interest, and we're gonna go on. We have 13 minutes, and I've got 10 people online, so I can't even give 2 minutes to each person. I can't give two minutes to each person. So right now, we'll try to have them back. Anyway, with that, Mr. McPherson, thank you very much for indulging us today with your constitutional perspective. And it was a privilege to have you on today. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator.
So we're going to move on, you guys. We have a lot more people than I was anticipating on public testimony today. So people online, we technically have 12 minutes left. We may, with the indulgence of the committee, be able to stay a few minutes late. Yes, do I need to move? Okay. I'm going to go ahead and open public testimony to Senate Bill 14. So with that, public testimony is open. Thank you. We are going to go ahead and start with the first person who called in. And if everyone could keep your remarks as tight as possible, 1 to 2 minutes, that would be terrific. We will end up taking an additional public testimony in writing, and we will announce the email that you send that to if you didn't get everything in. With that, Eleanor Andrews, please proceed.
Hello, I'm calling today as a private citizen, former business owner, commissioner of administration, and a seven-year member of the Alaska Judicial Council, and my comments today are in reference to Senate Bill 14. Our judicial selection process is not broken. We don't have judges being charged with illegal activities. We don't have our judges being challenged for lack of legal rigor. We don't have judges being selected who then ultimately are found to have committed crimes. I had many more comments, but I stayed on the line for an hour and 15 minutes to listen to the bill about masking. So at a future date, I am going to send written comments. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Eleanor. Okay, next we'll go to Karen Baker.
Hello. My name is Karen Baker. I'm a resident of Anchorage, and I am speaking on behalf of myself. Thank you for the opportunity to give testimony today. I oppose SB 14 and the politicization of judicial appointments in Alaska. We need to support the selection of the most qualified candidates as determined by the Alaska Judicial Council rather than let the governor appoint just any lawyer they like who has practiced in Alaska for a few years. As we've seen with our current governor's past attorney general choices, the governor is not always a good judge of character or fitness for judicial appointment. This is why we need a separate mechanism that ensures our judicial appointments are made based on merit rather than politics. Our state constitution created a good merit-based system for selecting and retaining judges in Alaska. Why are we now seeking to undermine Alaska's constitution and weaken our judicial branch? It is unnecessary and irresponsible to dismantle the system. Alaska doesn't need or want our legislators to pick apart our great constitution in order to politicize our democratic institution. Respect Alaska's constitution and protect our courts. Oppose SB 14. Additionally, I would like to take a moment to state that I am shocked and furious at what my tax dollars are paying for with this committee with what I've witnessed in the earlier portion of this
okay,
meeting.
Okay, this is not part of the testimony. We don't need that. We're not going to take comment on that. Are you done commenting on the judges? What's your affiliation, Karen Baker?
I am speaking on behalf of myself.
Thank you. We'll move on to Serene O'Hare.
Good afternoon. My name is Serene O'Hare Jolly, and I currently live in Senator Meyer's district. I am here in opposition to SB 14. Alaska's judicial and retention system is not broken. When Senator Myers was running for office, he spoke about how he would not get caught up in the power aspects of government and forget the basics of the job or the individuals he serves. He promised to keep a high level of integrity once elected. He talked about many problems facing individuals today were a result of expanding government. SB 14 is a bill that is trying to expand the government's reach into the process that is currently working. Having a nonpartisan group of peers recommending judges is an important separation of powers. Allowing the legislative branch of government to determine who is in the judiciary seems exactly like the government overreach of power that Senator Myers promised to stand with integrity against. Our state budget and current COVID-19 crisis with all of its health and economic effects should be the priority of the Senate, not this seemingly inappropriate power grab to insert the legislature's ideology on a separate branch of government. When the pandemic first hit last March, my two brothers who live here lost their jobs. Senator Myers and many others promised to make the budget their top priority. It is disheartening to see the Senate taking up this bill that is clearly in opposition to many members' values of smaller government and our state's values of separation of power. One of my brothers is still out of work almost a year later. I implore this committee to vote no on SB 14 and take up the much-needed work that positively impacts the lives of Alaskans. Thank you for your time.
Okay, and I want to tell all testifiers, we don't do personal pokes and stuff at different legislators, and so we would ask all testifiers to refrain from that. Thank you. Robin Smith, you're next.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. My name is Robin Smith. Thank you for hearing my testimony today. I am speaking solely for myself. Alaska has independent and highly qualified judges. Why? Alaska was one of the last state constitutions to be written. Alaskans came together and employed the best examples from other states to make our state's constitution the best. One of the most respected aspects of our constitution is the way in which Alaska chooses and retains judges. Our constitution balances the necessity of three important aspects: impartiality, high quality, and the opportunity for people to remove a judge through a vote. According to the Brennan Center for Justice, over the past several decades, judicial selection has become increasingly politicized. We can trace this trend to the 1980s, when special interests from lawyers to corporations to politicians looked to the selection of state court judges and saw an opportunity to shape the courts to advance their personal goals. Rather than settle for a fair and impartial and independent judiciary, they saw how easy it would be to mold a friendly one. Merit selection and retention process is designed to reduce outside influences on the judiciary. Applicants need not make promises to individuals or special interest groups. The judicial branch is an important check on the other two branches of government. The public wants an impartial and fair court system. SB 14 would introduce politics into the process. It moves the system away from an independent, impartial, and highly qualified judiciary. Our merit-based judicial system is not broken. I am proud of Alaska's process for choosing and retaining judges. Today, our country is already excessively divided politically. Please keep politics out of our courts. Oppose SB 14. Thank you.
Thank you. Right at 2 minutes. Thank you. And we'll go to Michael Garvey. I believe you're with ACLU. Thank you for identifying your affiliation. Please proceed. You've got 2 minutes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to the committee for the opportunity to testify on Senate Bill 14. I am Michael Garvey, Advocacy Director for the American Civil Liberties Union of Alaska, which protects the civil rights and individual liberties enshrined in the U.S. and Alaska constitutions. The Alaska Constitution created a judicial system based on merit and independence. The Judicial Council is central to carrying out these values. We're concerned at the ways that SB 14 would increase the influence of politics on Alaska's courts and undermine the state's long-revered merit selection system. Specifically, we're concerned that the bill would allow a governor to appoint judges who are not nominated by the Judicial Council as the most qualified, require legislative confirmation of these appointees, force Judicial Council nominees to pass an ideological litmus test, and put the Commission on Judicial Conduct in charge of providing recommendations for retention elections rather than the Judicial Council, which already considers the Commission's work. It is clear how SB 14 would increase the influence of politics on the courts were it to pass. Filling judicial openings will be based on who can be confirmed rather than who is most qualified. It will become a new animating factor in how the House and Senate organize. And the legislature will be empowered to enforce the bill's ideological test, which amounts to telling judges how to do their jobs. Our objection to this bill is not partisan. It is anchored by the fact that Alaska's framers, as others have noted, working with the knowledge of how almost every other state's judiciary functioned, deliberately chose to adopt strong measures to keep Alaska's courts independent and insulate them from the vagaries of the political process. Our courts have operated exceptionally well under the system. The practical effect of SB 14 would be to weaken the performance of the state's judiciary while opening the system to the influence of whoever occupies the governor's office and whoever holds power in the legislature, the opposite of what the framers intended. For these reasons, we oppose SB 14. Thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony today.
Thank you, Michael. We're next. We're going to Lynette Pham.
Hi, my name is Lynette. I live in Anchorage, and I'm speaking for myself in opposition of Senate Bill 14. As elected officials, you understand the power of constituents. Otherwise, you would not be in office today. I'm disappointed by this bill that actively wants to take away power from constituents to elect judges and give them more power to the governor. This bill would enact something that already has shown major issues considering what occurred with both former Alaska attorney generals appointed by the governor. This year, whom have already was an extreme lack of care and consideration to whom is appointed. All Alaskans believe that judges should be selected based on their legal qualifications. Fairness and experience should oppose this legislation. Please vote no on Senate Bill 14.
Thank you, Lynette. We're going to Bob, and I'm not going to say your last name. If you could say your first and last name for the record, that would be great. Please proceed. You've got 2 minutes.
Thank you. My name is Bob Grossclose, G-R-O-S-E-C-L-O-S-E. I live in Fairbanks. I'm a practicing lawyer, have been for 45 years. I have served on both the Alaska Judicial Council, 6-year term, ending in 2006, and I've also served on the Judicial Conduct Commission, a 3-year term. I've also been a member briefly on the Board of Governors. SB 14 would inject politics into a system that has worked well, that by design of our constitutional drafters was intended to assure that we have an independent judiciary in this state. The Judicial Council works hard at what it does. It selects and screens judicial applicants.
Bob, if you could wrap up, because we're over time right now, if you could just make it one closing statement.
Well, my closing statement would be to urge the Senate to reject Senate Bill 14, as I do not believe it furthers the design of the Constitution, and it would impede our ability to maintain and preserve an independent judiciary. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you, Bob. Jay Smith, you are next, and then we got two more. If committee members can hold on just 5 minutes max. Just 1 second. I got to make sure I have approval. Everybody approve? Okay, so Jay, please proceed.
Hey, thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I'm Jay Smith. I'm repping all patriots out here in Eagle River and everywhere else. I just want to say that I'm hearing a lot of people saying here today a lot of different things, and I want to echo some of those things. The main thing I want to say is we just need to unmask the tyranny here. You know, all you got to do is take one look around to see who's benefiting from this pandemic, and it ain't me or you. The truth is much hairier, ladies and gents, and this is a time where we need unity, you know.
Jay, we're taking testimony only on Senate Bill 14 right now. Do you have comments in regards to Senate Bill 14?
Yeah, I just want to say, you know, you just got to take a look around and recognize that we are blurring the lines here between physical, digital, and biological worlds, and our candidate overlords are just sitting there laughing. You know, you can lie, you can't lie with facts, and the fact is a normal virus don't act this way. This is science. Just like Senator Reinbold was saying earlier, science is measurable. And, you know, people get viruses all the time. They don't even know it. But this time our so-called best friends have bested us.
Okay. Jay, do you have comments in regards to Senate Bill 14? Oh, the judges. We're taking testimony right now on the Judicial Council and the judges.
Well, look, I get that you can't say a lot of this stuff without triggering the libs, but all you got to do is take one look at the dogs in this country and see that it's a carefully orchestrated, canine-driven hoax to keep us all at home,
okay.
Doling out the treat.
Okay, Jay, you've hit your two-minute mark. I'm sorry, we're running late today. So.
And we would have if we weren't so distracted by the stimulus checks and the lying media. Our dogs have clearly taken control of our...
Okay, with that, Jim Minery with Alaska Family Council.
Yeah, hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, hi. Yeah, I'll make this as short as I can. Alaska Family Council represents tens of thousands of folks across the state, and we believe that involvement of both the executive and legislative branches in judicial selection would actually help promote a more accountable judiciary and thereby enhance public confidence in our court system. The existing judicial selection process puts way too much authority in the Alaska Judicial Council, which is dominated by members of the Alaska Bar Association. We actually did a study ourselves, a comprehensive study of the Bar Association, showing that the exact opposite on the Bar Association is what's reflected in the public in terms of Republican versus Democrat. The ABA is a professional guild with 2,300 active members. That represents less than one-half of 1% of the state population, and yet four of the seven seats on the Judicial Council are held by ABA members. And that's not by chance, that's by design. And it effectively gives a tiny legal elite unchecked power to control one-third of the state government. I'm going to read a quick quote from Vic Fisher's book called The Alaska's Constitutional Convention. And this was done in 1955. The consultants to the Convention Committee on the Judiciary warned of this very thing, giving the ABA, the Alaska Bar Association, too much power. This is the quote. These sections in particular, however, go a long way toward withdrawing the judicial branch from the control of the people of the state and placing it under that of the organized bar. No state constitution has ever gone this far in placing one of the three coordinate branches of the government beyond the reach of democratic controls. We feel that in its desire to preserve the integrity of the courts, the convention has gone farther than is necessary or safe in putting them in the hands of a private professional group, however public-spirited its members may be, unquote. And so, regrettably, the chairman of the committee on the judiciary back in
Jim, if you could wrap up your comments, you're right at 2 minutes.
You bet, no problem. SB 14 does not cure every shortcoming in the current judicial selection process, but it's a significant step in the right direction. We urge your favorable consideration of SB 14.
Okay,
thank you so much for your time.
And with that, there was two people that signed on, Ryan at 3 p.m., and we're going to ask those two individuals to call back. We are keeping public testimony open. We've gotten a big stack of it, and I know this is only part of it, but we will keep this open. I will tell you on Friday, we have invited the courts to come before this committee on Friday, so this hearing will continue. With that, we are gaveling out at 3:05. Thank you.